From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Bianca Freire Medeiros has spent years studying Brazil's favelas.
And the city, like Rio, would be unimaginable without the favela population. If all those workers stopped going to work, doesn't matter which kind of activity they do, the city would just stop because it's completely dependable on that workforce.
On today's show, we'll talk about favela tourism and its impact on Brazil. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss recent allegations of a potential acoustic attack on U.S. diplomats in Havana and the current political and economic difficulties between Poland and the European Union.
If it was to be a break, it would be very much against what popular opinion is, at least right now.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about Cuba, first of all. So an interesting development this week where U.S. diplomats in Cuba have been complaining about some sort of symptom. They think there's been something of an acoustic attack. This was kind of news to me, I think news to you, maybe news to all of us, about how this works exactly. But a couple of diplomats have been brought home, treated medically for this type of attack on our diplomats there. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, it sounds like it's from science fiction or something. There were some diplomats and their families, and of course, diplomats are living in the residences provided for them. They were having symptoms of significant hearing loss, and a number of them had to be brought home. This was actually happening about a year ago, and we've also learned recently that there were some Canadian officials that were having some of the same symptoms. Thankfully, no children were affected. So this has all been happening. The United States pulled back and sent some of the Cuban diplomats that were in D.C. in May sent them back, and I don't think we knew exactly what that was about, but we're learning that that is in response to this. And the Cuban government is now saying that they had nothing to do with it. They're starting an investigation, and they're going to try to figure out what has happened. But the theory is that it is, as you say, some sort of an acoustic attack. And if Cuba isn't responsible, there are some that are speculating that this may be some sort of third party, be that a third state or some sort of other group that has been doing this. But it sounds so unreal, but very, very serious and very significant.
But obviously trying to make the lives of these diplomats kind of miserable while they're there working. I don't get any indication, though, that it's kind of a listening device or anything like that, but just kind of a daily attack on someone's ability to hear and live comfortably.
Yeah, it's unclear whether that was actually the motivation or if the motivation was something else and this was just a negative consequence of that. So we'll see. It's going to be interesting to watch Cuba. As you mentioned, the Trump relationship is interesting. And of course, 2018 is the year that Raul Castro says that he's going to retire, though there is some speculation with the relationship with Trump right now that he may not do that. So we will watch next year.
All right, we will be. Let's talk about Poland then. There's some interesting news about Poland's current state of affairs with the European Union. Of course, Poland's been a member of the European Union, was one of the first to join as it expanded after the Cold War. And yet Poland has been kind of pushing back on some issues, has been doing some, I guess, illegal logging. There's some domestic changes and domestic affairs, political issues that the EU is pushing them on. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there, because we maybe start seeing other member states pushing back on the EU a little bit in perhaps the long wake now of Brexit.
Yeah, about 2 weeks ago, there were some major protests in the streets, and this came about because the leading party, the Law and Justice Party, they were trying to regain control or gain control of the judiciary and saying that they got final approval over all judiciary appointments. Now, this does not sit well with the European Commission. We want to have a separation of powers, much like we have in the United States. And so they have been pushing back against Poland for this. And of course, the Law and Justice Party then has got their backs up as well. Now, the president did decide that he was going to veto that legislation, so that has not gone forward, but that has caused all sorts of problems. And we see this week that there was a former prime minister who is now with the European Council, Donald Tusk, that said that this could lead to the end of Poland's relationship with the EU. Now, that seems very unlikely. But there are many saying that this is as close to a break as one could have imagined, and it's odd that it's Poland. One thing to keep in mind is the Polish people, not necessarily this political party, but the Polish people have been very pro-EU. Most of the surveys that have been done, they're in the 70th percentile in terms of approval ratings. And if you think of the UK and the Brexit, those approval ratings were nowhere near that. So if it was to be a break, it would be very much against what popular opinion is, at least right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, for being here and giving us these updates. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU, and I'm at Suzek Werlot. Next, we'll talk about Brazil's favelas with Bianca Freire Medeiros. I'm Suzek Werlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Werlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Bianca Freire Medeiros is a professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of São Paulo. Her research focuses on how American media portray Brazil and on tourism within Brazil's favelas. Her books include The Rio de Janeiro That Hollywood Invented and Touring Poverty. She spoke with my colleague, Rebecca Cruz.
Bianca Freire Medeiros, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful that you're joining us, and we can talk about a number of issues relating to Brazil. But one of the issues I think that comes up very frequently, something that you have studied, is the favela situation in Brazil. So maybe we could step back and you could tell us a little bit about what exactly a favela is. Mm-hmm. How would we characterize it? Who is there? How do those people sustain themselves? Anything that you think would be helpful for our listeners as we try to understand a term I think that's thrown around more and more, but perhaps we don't exactly know what we're thinking of.
Okay. It's a very complicated term to be defined to start with, right? It became as a favela was related to a specific urban form that started in Rio de Janeiro in the early 20th century, but it became generalized as a term to every poor and segregated and violent neighborhood throughout Brazil. So in this process, it became more general, more less specific, less historically related, and with all sorts of consequences to it, right? And what we see in the beginning, especially the beginning of the 21st century, was this also commodification of the favela brand as a brand. So this is something new that adds also like another layer of complexity to something that was already very complex. And especially because this idea that every poor person in Brazil lives in a favela is a mistake. That's not true. This idea also that every favela is about poverty and violence, that's a misconception as well. So it's complicated.
Well, it's a uniquely Brazilian concept then, a Brazilian term. And how would we characterize it separately from other poor neighborhoods? As you said, not every mm-hmm. poor person lives in a favela, mm-hmm. but there are these unique urban settings mm-hmm. that constitute a favela. So what exactly makes them unique other than these perhaps stereotypical ideas of poverty and violence?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a challenge even for the census in Brazil. Mm. In how to classify those neighborhoods. In very basic terms, what they all have in common is the lack of formality in terms of ownership of the land, right? But this can mean many things. But this would be like the common ground and precarious sewage system. That would be another characteristic. But it varies a lot depending on where they are located in the city. Most people have, especially international audiences, they have the idea that favelas are necessarily up in the hill with a beautiful view to the ocean.
And right? We often see images
of course,
pictures.
That's kind of, you know, the favela that inhabits the international imagination.
Sure.
But most favelas are on flat grounds, and they are far from the ocean. And this is it implies also a different dynamic in terms of distribution of land or in terms of transport or in terms of mobility within the city. Yeah, so it's they can, and when the favela is big enough, as for instance, Rocinha, where I conduct my research, there are variations within the favela itself. So you have parts which are more urbanized, for instance, and other parts which are very precarious. So you have difference within that space as well. I'm not avoiding the question, but it's just that it's still something. It has been debated a lot within, like, amongst urbanists and sociologists, I don't know, anthropologists, whatever. What does the term favela mean and how useful it is in terms of, it's not a concept in terms of a scientific concept. It's much more of a common sense idea, which is very, very embedded in prejudice and stereotypes.
So yeah. There's a great deal of stratification even within the favelas.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And they, in many ways, take on a life of their own in terms of governing the structure and those sorts of things. Or
yeah, but that's a problematic idea, too, because then it comes to mind the whole ghetto idea, right? And no, favelas are part of the city, okay. Right? They are totally within the city structure. And the city, and that we have the saying, in even like it's a political statement, of course, favela is cidade, so favela is city, right? And the city, like Rio, would be unimaginable without the favela population, right? If all those workers stop going to work, you know, doesn't matter which kind of activity they do, the city would just stop because it's completely dependable on that workforce. So it's not a ghetto in these terms. They have the same political rights, the same social rights and civil rights. But of course, we are talking about a very uneven country, right? So many things that are deemed acceptable, if we are like police violence would be accepted. If we are talking about a favela territory and things that would be totally unaccepted in a formal neighborhood, quote unquote.
So the policing is different. They're treated differently.
Yes.
Because they're in the favela, because there's often a racial component as well.
The
poverty.
Racial component is totally part of it. And it's completely related to the militarization of daily lives in Brazil. We are a democratic country. And we've been for over three decades now, but we still have this presence of the police force in very violent and arbitrary ways. So it's very common to have on a daily basis people being killed in the favelas, regardless of being related to any form of illegal activity. So this would be something that people would be totally unaccepted if it were Copacabana or Ipanema or, you know. And, yeah, that's how it is.
You're listening to a conversation between my colleague, Rebecca Cruz, and Brazilian sociologist, Bianca Freire Medeiros. After the break, we'll discuss favela tourism. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest today is Bianca Freire Medeiros. She's a sociologist at the University of Sao Paulo. Before the break, she was speaking with my colleague, Rebecca Cruz, about police violence in Brazil's favelas.
Well, you mentioned the economic impact of many of these workers that are contributing throughout the city. We've also seen in the last couple of decades the commodification of the favelas in terms of tourism and Westerners in many cases, but other tourists coming and looking at the favelas, taking tours throughout the favelas. Racine, you mentioned, is one of the big ones. Tell us a little bit about how this got started and what the people inside the favelas feel about this. I imagine it's both an economic boon in the sense that there's money coming in, but at the same time, there are strangers, international people looking, a kind of a voyeurism that's taking place, perhaps.
It's a very complex phenomenon, and we are celebrating, quote-unquote, now 25 years of tourism activities, because the origin would be the 1992 Rio Summit conference. And it has actually an interesting origin, because it started as a grassroots activity led by Greenpeace and some local groups, actually to denounce the whole thing that was going on during that event. And the whole thing about the government was trying to hide the favelas and have this army, the soldiers and tanks, protecting the international visitors from the favela. And it backfired totally. It just made people more curious about it. But it was then that it started like a market itself, right? Like, so we started having this private tourism, like agents taking groups and charging for it, right? So it started very like in marginal, in the sense that it had nothing to do with the government in terms of sponsorship or regulation. And it was like this for like over 15 years. It started actually getting the government involved during the Meg events phase.
Of course.
Right? So we started having this with the Pan American Games in 2007. And from then on, the government started to be more and more involved in this activity.
And by involved, you mean regulating,
taxing? Not taxing, but giving incentive, financial incentive, preparing, offering courses for tourist guides and things like this, but it's still. What we are talking about is a very diverse phenomenon, because in Rocinha, the first one we're talking about, like the paradigmatic one, for most of the time, it was about private people, private agents from outside the favela profiting over it, right? Taking international groups of tourists in different ways, like on a jeep, like a safari jeep, walking tours, motorcycle tours, all sorts of different packages. But from the 2000s on, or at least mid-2000s on, we started having other favelas and having different tourism activities, and many of them having the residents themselves as the main agents, right? The main stakeholders. So this makes a lot of difference. And this is going back to your question about how the residents feel. It all depends, right? But even in Rocinha, when I was doing my research in 2000, I was there between 2005 and 2009, 10. Yeah, residents would mostly support it, although they were not having any sort of profiting out of it, right? We're talking about a very big community. It's like 170,000 residents. Although the the tourist market, it is sold as 1 million people, but it's nothing like that, right?
So the tours are coming in and not disrupting the lives of these people, and so they don't see this as being detrimental?
It might disrupt for those who are on the path.
Directly, yes.
Yeah, right? But at this point, they're completely used to it, right? Okay. To this kind of exposure. But then again, it all depends. Some tours are more invasive. Others are less invasive. There is this generation difference too. Most young people are more willing to be like taking pictures, especially the children. They are very willing to take pictures and like be nice to the tourists. But there is also this, and I think this is something that needs to be highlighted, is the fact that we are talking about a community that has been seen in the news and all over the world as this violent and extremely violent and poor place. And they think and they imagine that tourists coming, they can have a counter image, right? They can see that it's not only about violence. The tourists can see that it's not only about poverty. They'll have this this better idea of the place. And in some ways, you're right. The residents are right, because the tourists, actually, they come after the tour, they have a more complex image of the place, right? And a more complex understanding. But it's far from being, how can I say it? It's still, you cannot expect much of a three-hour tour.
Right, right.
Right? And it's mostly about taking pictures. It's mostly about like this visual experience more than anything else. We have the language barrier. Most tourists come from countries where they don't know Portuguese. Residents, most of them, of course, don't speak English. There isn't enough time for interaction. So it's mostly a visual and extremely like sensorial experience because it also, it has all this, it's really overwhelming in terms of landscape and noise and you know, like the people going about. It's very intense. Yeah, but it's mostly about international tourists to begin with, like Racine. But on these more recent experiences, we get to have more Brazilians joining, usually from other parts of the country, they would call. But it's still a more international, mostly, we're talking mostly about international tourists coming from the rich north. Right. Yeah.
So a very complex situation, lots of people involved, lots of feelings and viewpoints for sure. Well, we will continue to see if there happens to be another 25 years of favela tourism and what's to come next. But thank you so much for joining us today and sharing us your insights with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a conversation with Bianca Freire Medeiros. She teaches in the Department of Sociology at University of São Paulo. She spoke with my colleague, Rebecca Cruz. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Berlotte.